chose to betray both morality and economic common sense by approving Trump's one big ugly bill. John, welcome back to Democracy Now. Can you talk about the significance of what took place? I mean, interestingly, while the tax cuts go into effect immediately, is this correct? The Medicaid cuts will happen after the midterms.
That's exactly right. This bill was drawn as a political document. There's no question of what Donald Trump and the Republicans in congressional leadership wanted to do. They wanted to do what Republicans have done in every circumstance where they've gotten the White House in recent decades, and that is a massive tax cut for the wealthy. In this case, roughly I hope I've got the number right. It keeps kind of moving up and down. But, it's in the, multiple trillions of dollars over the period of what we're talking about here. But they also had to figure out some ways to, quote unquote, pay for this. And as you suggest, they put the tax cut for the wealthy up front. I mean, that's going to come across the board. And then they put a lot of damaging, almost poison pills into the document as regards all of these safety net programs. And so a lot of the cuts will come over time. People won't feel them immediately. And yet, this is the bottom line. In states across the country, not according to liberal Democrats, not according to progressive think tanks, but according to Republicans who are on the ground in these states and one Republican in the U.S. Senate, Tom Tillis, this is going to have a devastating impact on Medicaid, on health, access to health care, so that we will get to a point where roughly 5% of Americans are at threat of losing their health care. That's a massive, massive shift. In addition, you've got roughly 12 million people at risk of losing SNAP anti-hunger benefits. And when we look at all the numbers here, because of the way that the tax cuts are massively weighted toward the wealthy, you have members of Congress who are pretty serious analysts of all this, telling us that roughly 40%, going to underline that, 40% of Americans will end up worse off under this. They won't get a significant tax cut. They will lose health benefits. They will lose anti-hunger benefits and a lot of other benefits as well. This is the most massive transfer of wealth upward in American history. And yet it's designed to create a circumstance where Republicans can run in 2026 and claim that they didn't do the damage. I'll give you one more set of facts that are just useful. This comes from Governor Andy Beshear in Kentucky. Kentucky is a state that votes quite Republican in federal elections. Beshear is a Democrat, but he's had to work with a Republican legislature. He's a very kind of facts and numbers guy. He says this is the worst piece of federal legislation in his lifetime. He says that 200,000 Kentuckians, this is just one state, 200,000 Kentuckians will lose health care. 20,000 health care workers will lose their jobs. And as many as 35 rural hospitals are now in danger of closing in that one state. And that doesn't even take in the devastating impact to nursing homes, especially in small towns.
I want to ask you about the Republican Congress member, Derek Van Orden of Wisconsin, who voted for Trump's budget bill, even as he called on your governor, Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers, to sign the state budget before Trump signed the federal budget bill into law on July 4th. He wrote in a letter, quote, delaying the state budget enactment beyond July 3rd risks losing vital opportunities for the state's health care system and the Wisconsinites who rely on it. Health care and rural health care in particular is vital to us in Wisconsin. We cannot leave anything on the table. Explain what's going on here.
Sure. This new law has all sorts of draconian components to it that are incredibly damaging to the way in which states have set up their healthcare systems. Remember, states across the country get federal funding, and then they establish a state-based healthcare system for working people who can't afford the high cost of healthcare. And those systems often have an intermingling of federal and state money. The way that what this bill does, it created a circumstance where states that didn't have a budget locked in with a program for spending that state and federal money by July 1st ran the risk of, or by, you know, the, before the bill was passed, I should say, before the federal bill was passed, ran the risk of losing substantial amounts of money. So to give you an example, in Wisconsin, Governor Tony Evers, knowing that this was indeed a real risk, signed the bill after 1 a.m. The other day. You know, literally it was up into the middle of the night. So as soon as it got through the legislature, they signed the new Wisconsin budget. And that is because this federal bill, as it, it implements, is going to make it dramatically harder for the states to establish and maintain healthcare programs for working people who can't afford. And if I can just give you one more factoid on that, if we can use that word, Tom Tillis, the senator from North Carolina, Republican senator from North Carolina, a former Republican legislative leader, said what this bill does is sort of, you know, kind of blow apart the systems that states have set up to establish their health care programs.
And John, just very finally, you had Lisa Murkowski saying what's good for Alaska is not necessarily good for the country. This bill is not good for the many Americans in the country. They got carve outs right to get them to say that was Murkowski. Thune himself, the Senate majority leader in South Dakota, they got carve outs to protect their, for example, rural hospitals.
They did in some cases. But I will emphasize to you that while there were some techniques, some tricks kind of put in here to help rural hospitals, they will not be sufficient. And more damaging here, not discussed at nearly the level it should have been, is rural nursing homes. And the way that this bill is written, it poses a dramatic threat to nursing homes across the country. There is a real possibility that millions of families that, that go through that devastating challenge of trying to figure out how to care for an elder or a person with disabilities are going to be put into one of the most devastating circumstances that the government has ever imposed on folks as regards health care.
John Nichols, I want to thank you for being with us, national affairs correspondent for The Nation. His new piece will link to at democracynow.org. Republicans just voted to do immoral and irreparable harm to the United States. Speaking to us from Madison, Wisconsin, at the news conference following Trump's so-called big, beautiful bill, Republican Speaker Mike Johnson of Louisiana answered a question from Rolling Stone reporter Antonia Yuhas about how the law's gutting of environmental and climate justice funding from the Inflation Reduction Act would impact rural Louisiana. This was Johnson's response.
I think a lot of the estimations about what this legislation would do in a negative manner to communities in my state or any other are far overblown. I can tell you that this bill is going to be a great thing for everybody around the country, my constituents especially. What's good for Louisiana is good for America. We've got great tax policy here. I think they're going to feel this pretty quickly. Wages will rise. I think household income will go up. I think the job participation rate will increase dramatically. I think unemployment will be low. We're going to duplicate what we did in the first Trump administration. Remember, at the first 2 years, y'all have heard me say 1,000 times, it's objectively true. We had one of the greatest economies in the history of the world, and we're going to do that again, except this time much more comprehensively. We did tax cuts and regulatory reform, and that brought about a resurgence of the U.S. economy. That's what's going to happen here. It's about to happen on steroids. And we can't wait for that to happen. This is jet fuel for the economy, and all boats are going to rise.
So that was House Speaker Johnson's response to reporter Antonia Yuhas, who's doing just published a piece for Rolling Stone magazine. One of the groups who will see their funding cut is Inclusive Louisiana. Antonia reports the group received $500,000 grant with local partner groups, Louisiana Bucket Brigade and Rural Roots. The grant was awarded through an Inflation Reduction Act Environmental and Climate Justice Block Grant program that provides financial assistance to groups working to address local environmental or public health issues in their communities. The grant terminated in May by the Trump administration. This is an ad they had made for their campaign, Imagine St. James Parish.
For too long, petrochemical plants have been poisoning our people. And with the approval of the St. James Parish government,
building more facilities that spew toxic chemicals into historically black communities.
But now we are reclaiming our future.
Together, we can imagine a pollution-free St. James Parish.
And we can build an inclusive economy.
What can you imagine?
Tell us at imaginestjamesparish.org. Paid for by Inclusive Louisiana.
For more, we are joined by Antonia Yuhas in Washington, D.C., where she followed the budget bill negotiations. Award-winning longtime investigative journalist covering oil and energy and regular contributor to Rolling Stone magazine. Her latest piece, They're Fighting Polluters, Trump's Tax Bill Guts Their Funding. Across Louisiana, communities are bracing for the tax bill's massive cuts to critical funding for local community organizing and resilience. Among her books is The Tyranny of Oil. Antonia, welcome back to Democracy Now! We just have a few minutes before we talk about what's happening in Gaza. And we wanted to ask you, you got in that last question to the House Speaker. Explain what you were asking about and his response.
Yeah, so I had been traveling across rural Louisiana to investigate the impacts of the tax bill on environmental and climate justice and environment more broadly. And I had asked the speaker, what would he say to those communities that are going to be cut off now as a result of the tax bill? And you heard his lengthy response. The facts are that this bill zeroes out to the best extent that it could do the Inflation Reduction Act. Biden's signature climate bill. It includes the zeroing out of environmental and climate justice grants, that some 800 of them, and programs that went to help local frontline communities confront polluters in their area. This bill has been called the worst environmental bill in U.S. history. You started with the Texas floods. We know that the climate crisis kills. We also know that we have remedies. Cut fossil fuels, transition to localized renewable energy, and support frontline communities. Those programs have essentially been erased to the best extent that they could in this tax bill to remove tax incentives that would help us support solar and wind energy, manufacturing, tax breaks for consumers, producers. Those were entirely stripped away to cut out that financial support for the solar and wind transition. Tax breaks, billions of them to the fossil fuel industry. And remember, this bill extends all of those tax cuts from 2017, which had already brought billions of dollars to the fossil fuel industry, and just gives them new benefits. One of the perks that Lisa Murkowski got for voting for the bill was opening up the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge to oil and gas drilling. There's other provisions that reduce the tax, royalties that the U.S. would get from drilling in public lands. So a big giveaway and an opening the door to more production. It provides more tax breaks to the fossil fuel industry. It eliminates rules, for example, that we're trying to address methane emissions. It's a Christmas tree for the fossil fuel industry. It's a frontal assault on environmental and climate justice, and it will set us back significantly unless we take action to confront the climate crisis. It was one big additional boondoggle for the fossil fuel industry and to harm local environmental and climate justice organizing and our national and international attempts to confront the climate crisis.
Antonia, the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, put 139 workers on leave after they publicly criticized Trump's environmental policies and signed a declaration of dissent last week. Many of them high-level people in the EPA were given like 10 minutes to leave their offices. Talk about what this declaration of dissent was.
So I've been interviewing for months Environmental Protection Agency staff. So the Trump administration has been working through the DOGE process, the EPA to gut environmental justice rules. It's been losing in court left and right. in those efforts. They've been found to be illegal. So therefore, the administration is trying to use, or did use, excuse me, the tax bill to achieve through that bill what it was losing through the courts. EPA employees working on environmental justice, working on climate, working on protecting our air, our water, protecting us from pollution, have been trying to speak out. They've been put on administrative leave. Many also accepted the early buyouts because they didn't want to have to deal with this administration. Others have been increasingly speaking out. And this letter that came out was the largest organizing of those EPA employees to state their opposition to what was happening. And the Trump administration then put 144 of them on administrative leave.
And we will link to that letter, that declaration of dissent, at democracynow.org. Antonia Yuhas, thanks so much for being with us. Longtime investigative journalist. Will link to her Rolling Stone piece. They're fighting polluters. Trump's tax bill guts their funding. Next up, we'll talk about Gaza. Could there be a truce? As the Israeli prime minister meets with President Trump in D.C. today, we'll speak with Dr. Feroz Sidwa, who's volunteered in Gaza and writes, "Hospital attacks in Gaza and Israel, what counts as a war crime?" Stay with us. By Fatoumata Jawra. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has arrived in Washington, D.C. for talks with President Trump. It's Netanyahu's third trip to Washington since Trump's inauguration in January. Once again, the U.S. will not enforce an international criminal court warrant seeking Netanyahu's arrest for war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in Gaza. Ahead of the meeting, Trump predicted there's a good chance Israel and Hamas will reach a deal on a new U.S.-promoted Gaza ceasefire framework, which Trump has called his final proposal for the Palestinians. Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip have killed at least 24 people so far today, following another bloody weekend that saw scores of Palestinians slaughtered. Among the dead, at least 6 people killed when Israel bombed a medical clinic in Gaza City housing displaced Palestinians. At least 15 others were wounded. Separately, Doctors Without Borders, Medecins Sans Frontières, known as MSF, is condemning the killing of Abdullah Hamad, a former MSF worker shot dead by Israeli forces July 3rd. Colleagues say Hamad was part of a group of Palestinians seeking to collect flour from an aid truck in Khan Yunis when Israeli forces attacked without warning, killing at least 16 people. Dr. Hamad is the 12th member of Doctors Without Borders killed by Israel's military since October 2023. Attacks on health facilities and medical workers in Gaza have been repeated and defining aspect of Israel's assault on Gaza. The World Health Organization reports 94% of hospitals in Gaza have been damaged or destroyed over the past 20 months, despite the fact hospitals are supposed to have protections under international law. In May, the Safeguarding Health and Conflict Coalition reported attacks on healthcare facilities worldwide have become more frequent over the last decade. And in 2024, a quarter of all the attacks on health facilities worldwide occurred in Gaza. Israel almost always justifies attacks on hospitals by accusing Hamas of militarizing these facilities. An incredible 609 healthcare workers in Gaza have been killed. Our next guest has witnessed the consequences of these attacks firsthand. Dr. Feroz Sidwa is a trauma, general, and critical care surgeon who volunteered in March at Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis, Gaza, with Med Global. Last year, he volunteered at the European Hospital during Israel's assault on Gaza. His new piece for the Council on Foreign Relations Think Global Health, is co-authored with attorney Leonard Rubenstein. It's headlined Hospital Attacks in Gaza and Israel, What Counts as a War Crime? Well, Dr. Feroz Sidwa, what counts as a war crime? Explain what has happened after what, in the latest news, we hear about this healthcare worker, this doctor who has just been killed online for food, and the director of the Indonesian hospital, the leading cardiologist, just killed as well in Gaza.
Yeah, Dr. Sultan, the actually, at this point, if I'm correct, I hope I'm right about this, but I'm pretty sure at this point that the director of every hospital north of the Netzarim corridor, so in the northern half of Gaza, has either been killed or is in Israeli detention. The reason Len and I wrote this article is because we hadn't really seen anything that brought together the fact that the attacks on healthcare in Gaza are really a defining feature of the U.S.-Israeli attack on the territory, and it's so widespread as to be really kind of unique in history.
So talk about the story of your 16-year-old patient, Ibrahim, the story you tell in your piece for the Council on Foreign Relations.
Sure. Yeah. On March 18th, that's when the widespread bombing of Gaza resumed since the January 19th ceasefire. And the last operation I did that day was in a 16-year-old boy named Ibrahim. He had injuries to his colon and rectum. I operated on him, stopped him from dying. And by March 23rd, in the evening, he was ready to go home. And I walked, I was on my way down to his room. We lived on the fourth floor of the hospital, and the men's surgical ward at that time was on the second floor. And on my way down the stairs, his room exploded. The Israelis fired probably a drone-fired missile into his room because they wanted to kill the other fellow in the room, a 56-year-old man who was also wounded and in the hospital receiving treatment, named Ismail Barhum. They were distant cousins, from what I understand, so the family or the nurses had put them in the same room to make family visits easier and things like that. Well, you know, that's a pretty shocking crime for a few reasons. Firstly, the Israelis said that Ismail, the target of the attack, was Hamas's prime minister in Gaza. Well, okay, nobody thinks you can blow up a hospital to kill Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel. That's just completely insane. Nobody would ever make such a claim. And of course, if Hamas did that, probably all of Gaza would be nuked. So there's no situation where you can treat people this way. Furthermore, it's completely illegal under international law. Wounded combatants who are receiving treatment at a hospital are not targets of attacks. In fact, they're a specifically protected class of people under international law. And the Geneva Conventions, I think it's Article 19 of the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949, if I'm remembering correctly, specifically state that the presence of wounded combatants or their sidearms is not considered an act harmful to the enemy as long in a hospital if they're receiving treatment there. So even if you thought that this man was a combatant, which again is ridiculous, even if somebody were to claim that, it's just completely outrageous to think that he can be attacked while in a hospital. So that's, you know, there's two war crimes right there. Next, the firing of explosive weapons into a surgical ward packed to the brim with people, just, you know, the mass casualty of March 18th alone, we saw 221 patients. This just packed to the brim with sick and wounded patients, with healthcare staff, and with a 16-year-old wounded boy in the same room. That's just, there's no scenario where that satisfies the requirement of international law to make all feasible precautions, not to destroy the hospital, not to kill healthcare workers, not to hurt patients, etc. So that's also a war crime. And then thirdly, just such reckless firing into a hospital that you almost kill an international healthcare worker like me. I was 2 minutes away from the room. This is just all outrageous behavior. And it's not something that we should be supporting.
You talk about the Iranian bombing of Beersheba in Israel and the horror people felt. And you say one war crime never justifies another, but Israeli leaders and their American supporters cannot feign outrage over Iranian war crimes when their own forces disregard the law with such impunity and constantly dissemble and obscure the truth while carrying out one of the most direct and systematic attacks on a healthcare system in recent memory. Can you talk about your conclusions from this and then the significance of this conversation today as Netanyahu meets with Trump? There's discussion of a possible 60-day ceasefire as Hamas and Israeli officials are meeting in Doha to supposedly hammer out a ceasefire.
Yeah, it's important for people to realize the attack on March 23rd and the lies told to justify it, the mangling of international law told to justify it, none of that is unique. We give several examples in the piece if anyone wants to read it, but literally every attack on a healthcare facility in Gaza has been justified by either a total misunderstanding, a willful misunderstanding of international law, or just outright lies. And, you know, there have been some pretty extreme examples. Like, for one thing we didn't talk about in the piece was something else that happened on March 23rd, the same day Ibrahim was killed in his room. That's the day that the 15 paramedics, civil defense workers, and the UN worker were killed in Tel Sultan near Rafah. The Israelis initially said that they fired on Hamas, approaching them in an ambulance. Well, when they dug up the mass grave of those 15 paramedics a few days later, they found one of their cell phones, and they found that absolutely nothing of the sort had happened. The guy had, I think his name was Rafat, he had videotaped the entire thing, and literally everything the Israelis had said was a lie. Well, okay, fine. Now the Israelis said, well, we have to investigate to appease people. The New York Times is saying, oh, maybe we lied about something. So they wrote up an investigation, which the Israeli media reported didn't even take account of the findings that the investigative team found when they did a recreation of the scenario in the West Bank. They found that what the commander had said was complete lies. They found that the commander literally endangered his own troops just to go and destroy these ambulances for no reason. None of this was in the report. And furthermore, the complete misunderstanding of international law, that you don't just get to attack ambulances because you think they might possibly pose a threat to you, this is completely outrageous. So this is a widespread problem. It's not just, you know, one example. And what it means for these ceasefire negotiations, it's difficult to say, but the problem with the ceasefire is that under no circumstances are Israel or the United States going to lift the blockade of Gaza. And the blockade of Gaza is exactly what led to October 7th. If we're just going to put the Gazans back into a concentration camp and let them continue to languish and die there, that's not a ceasefire. That's just, you can call it a piece of the graveyard if you like, but it's certainly not a step towards peace. I hope I'm wrong, and I hope the Trump administration has a miraculous turnaround, but I don't see that happening, unfortunately, unless Americans put pressure on it.
And what do you want to see happen right now, Feroz? You have Netanyahu coming for a series of days. He's meeting with President Trump today. He's meeting with Vance and Republican leaders tomorrow. He's meeting with Marco Rubio. What do you want to see come out of this meeting and what's happening in Doha, the Hamas-Israeli negotiators?
Well, just like under the Biden administration, I'd like the United States to be a country where the law matters. Benjamin Netanyahu is an accused war criminal. So should Donald Trump. So was Joe Biden. But the United States should be a place where we apply our laws to ourselves. That's the whole purpose of the law. It's completely illegal to continue to arm chronic and obstinate human rights abusers like Israel. And we should stop doing that. So, you know, I don't expect the Trump administration will all of a sudden think that the law matters, given its behavior. The Biden administration also never came to this reasonable conclusion. But the American people don't have to accept that we live in a lawless country where the government can just do whatever it wants. That's not the case. We have the power to act. We have the power to pressure the administration. We have the power to pressure our own Congress.
We have to leave it there. Dr. Feroz Sidwai, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Surgeon who volunteered in Gaza. We'll link to your piece for the Council on Foreign Relations.
CJSF is looking for new volunteers to come in and make radio. No experience is necessary. You can learn to DJ, edit sound, produce news, make posters, and host your own show. Come out to a weekly station orientation to get involved. Orientation times can be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.
Thank you for tuning in to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, BC.